Welcome to All Sides In with Ann Fisher. One day in May 1975, three young black men from the east side of Cleveland were arrested. Then they were later tried and convicted and sentenced to death for the murder of a white salesman outside of a convenience store. All of that occurred on the basis of the eyewitness testimony of a 12-year-old boy. In fact, they were innocent, nowhere near the site of the crime, but they served time, 106 years between them, before the truth came out. Award-winning journalist Kyle Swenson digs deep into the circumstances of how the cases against brothers Ronnie and Wiley Bridgman and their friend Ricky were managed by the criminal justice system and the city in his new book titled Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. Kyle Swenson joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
That was Ricky Jackson, I should say. Let's start with a thumbnail of what happened on that day and the murder scene and what occurred that they were accused of doing.
Absolutely. So May 19th, 1975, it was a late in the afternoon around 4 o'clock, and a money order salesman was making his routes through the east side of the city that day. And he stopped at his last stop, which was a convenience store on Fair Hill Boulevard, kind of on the very eastern edge of the city. Went into the store, did his business and transactions with the store owner. And as he was coming out, he was attacked by two men. He was beaten with a lead pipe. Acid was thrown in his face. And then he was fatally shot. And his satchel, which carried about a little under $500 in cash, was stolen. And the men disappeared. The assailants drove off.
So these three guys were just carrying on a typical kind of May Day. When the police asked a crowd of people gathering nearby, did anybody see anything? A 12-year-old popped out. What was his story?
So the 12-year-old's name was Ed Vernon. He was the neighborhood paper boy. He was kind of a geeky kid from what people have recollected to me. He was always around parents, always trying to curry favor with adults. So I believe when the crowd, there was a crowd formed around the store and Ed was in the crowd and a police officer asked if anybody had seen anything or anybody knew anything. And I believe Ed volunteered, again, this is a 12-year-old boy, just to be helpful, thinking that it was probably the right thing to do. But that led him down this path that led to the wrongful arrest and conviction of these three guys from the neighborhood.
And, you know, how could this happen? There were witnesses that a trio were nowhere near the scene of the crime. Where were their neighbors? Where was everybody?
There were. So people had been with Ricky and Ronnie, who were kind of best friends. Ronnie was 17 years old at the time. Ricky was 18. They had been with friends at the time this crime happened. There were other people who had been with Wiley, who was a little older. Wiley Bridgman, he was around 21. But no one spoke up. No one volunteered this information because in the city of Cleveland at the time, there was this great fear and distrust among the black community about the police. This had been simmering for a number of years. And you got to remember, this was not too long after the Huff riots, the Glenville shootout, and a lot of racial tension that had really boiled over across Cleveland. And there was just fear and animosity between the black community and the police at that time. And so that's why I believe a lot of people were scared to volunteer information or offer up any info that they had.
And this kind of fear, this divide, went all the way to the top, right, in the city?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the more remarkable things about Cleveland is that in 1967, you have the election of Carl Stokes, who's the first African-American man to be elected as the mayor of a major American city. And this was very significant in the city. It was a huge moment in the civil rights movement in general, and it's been kind of forgotten about, actually, today, Stokes has. But Stokes was also a reformer, and he came in with a very concise agenda about reforming the police department, and that actually only increased a lot of the animosity between the African-American community and the police department in Cleveland.
In 1975, the police department in Cleveland was like a lot of police departments across the country. Things had not yet changed. I don't know, had the Serpico story been told in New York City by then, or that was in the 60s a little earlier? But
that's a great question, because that was unfolding, and that was called the Serpico case, which is the famous whistleblower of the NYPD. That was part of something called the Knapp Commission, which really kind of cleared out a lot of bad elements in the NYPD. And it's interesting because that triggered a lot of similar corruption probes and commissions across police departments in the country. In Cleveland, however, Cleveland definitely had bad headlines. It had cops who were running wild. It had many, many issues with law enforcement. But there wasn't really the political will there to have a similar Knapp Commission-style house cleaning. And I think that really impacted the city for decades to come.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about what happened in 1975 to the Bridgman brothers and Ronnie Jackson, Ricky Jackson. It was the day Ricky Jackson and, anyways, the three boys who were young men who were accused, charged, convicted, and then sentenced to death for their roles in the murder of a white salesman, in East Cleveland, on the very outer edges of East Cleveland. It turned out none of it was true. They were exonerated finally in 2014. My guest is Kyle Swenson. He's an award-winning journalist and author of the new book, Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, you know, and in fact, you know, Bad City is a reference to Cleveland. A lot of this story is about the city of Cleveland and what's going on there at the time. And you said they didn't have the political will, but you kind of paint this picture of Cleveland as well as a city that does turn inward, does take hard looks at itself, does own the burning Cuyahoga River, you know, kind of a thing. What was different here?
Historically, that's very true. I mean, there's a great kind of grand tradition in Cleveland and across the Midwest, in many cities in the Midwest, of civic discourse, of civic involvement, of kind of open debate, talking out issues in a civic-wide scale. And in Cleveland, there was a very proud tradition of that. But that, unfortunately, by the 1970s, I think because of a lot of the racial divisions that were kind of ripping up ripping up cities across the country, that political will and that engagement had been kind of burned out by this point. And I think, as I mentioned before, I think that really created this kind of electrified binary between a lot of groups within the city, including the African-American community and the police.
The crime itself was heinous. It was horrible. Did they ever find who really did it?
No, they didn't. And that's one of the great injustices about wrongful convictions, because obviously you have innocent people who are going to prison, but then you have a crime itself that isn't solved. And there's families of the victims that don't get that resolution that they need.
More than 100 Americans, mostly African-American, were exonerated of crimes in the United States last year. And I'm wondering, from your research and from your reporting, if there's a pattern, is there a template that can explain what's going on? And do the three men that you write about in the book, do they fit into any kind of those patterns?
Well, as I write, you know, the criminal justice system in this country isn't necessarily wired very well to handle claims of innocence. You know, once that judge's gavel slams and the jury's verdict's in, it's very difficult for a person to bring claims of innocence to a court, to the higher courts, to the appellate courts. And there isn't that much will within the system itself, I think, to look back seriously at its own mistakes. And one of the reasons I wrote this book was that I was hoping to give a full account of what happened here as a learning lesson, as a way of documenting and having a full record of what happened, who was involved, so we could move forward and learn from what happened.
What tipped the scales for you in writing this book? Why did you think it was necessary?
Well, so my involvement began in this case in 2011 when I was a reporter at a weekly in Cleveland called The Cleveland Scene. And at that time, I met a man named Kwame Ajamu, who happened to be Ronnie Bridgman. He had changed his name in prison, and he had since paroled out, moved on with his life, really. He was married. He had a job. He owned a house. He had moved on, and his life was very different. But Ricky Jackson and his brother, Wiley Bridgman, were still in prison. And so he asked me to look in this case, and I wrote an investigative piece about the story, looking into the testimony specifically of the 12-year-old boy and how inconsistent it was from trial to trial. that eventually led, along with the work, the great work of the Ohio Innocence Project in 2014, to their exonerations. Specifically, Ricky Jackson's case was the one that was filed, and Ricky and Wiley were released in November 2014. But what really prompted me to write this book was this was a great day. These men walked free. Ricky Jackson had been in prison for 39 years. The time was the longest wrongful conviction to end in exoneration in U.S. history. So this is a wonderful day, but it was kind of a media event. You know, all the news cameras were there. There was national press. And these men walk free out of prison, and they get hit with these questions about, well, what are you going to do first? What will your first meal be? Where will you go? What's changed since you've left? And I thought these questions were very shallow and kind of strangely focused, not on what had happened, but what these men would do next. And I thought we really needed to take that look back and find out how this happened.
You know, they were shallow, but they were also typical. It's kind of typical of that knee-jerk press reaction when something like this happens.
Yeah, and I understand the gravity of the situation is very hard to digest in a shorter news clip and even in a question like that. But I thought it was really important, as I said, to dive deep into exactly how this happened, because without that, you know, we're doomed to repeat this type of history again.
It kind of triggered that anger in you.
It did. Yeah. I say that I wrote this book because I got a little fired up about it, because I felt that the city was kind of getting off. And I say bad city in the title, and I don't necessarily mean Cleveland itself, but the city as a government, as a police department, as a prosecutor's office, you know, the official representation of the city. I had this idea that without that full accounting that I keep mentioning, we weren't holding the city accountable, and there was no accountability whatsoever to what was done to these men. It's interesting, when I would talk with these guys, and I spent, you know, many, many, many hours with them, they often talked about they. They said, they did this to us. They tried to take our life. And I realized that they didn't have any more specifics besides they. They couldn't say it was such and such police officer. It was such and such prosecutor. And I thought, as I mentioned, it was critical to name those names, to outline what happened and who did it, because there is a certain, you know, they're not getting any satisfaction from saying they did this. I think it's important we can specify who was involved.
Did you know that the nature, very nature of the city would become such a main character in this?
I knew, you know, I'm from Cleveland. I had reported there for a number of years. I knew the city. I knew its dynamics. And I knew that this was a Cleveland story, very much so. But I also knew it was a way of talking about American cities and American civic institutions like our court systems and our police departments, and specifically the way that they've changed over the last 60 years. So this is very, as I said, this is very much a Cleveland story, but I think it's a story really about American cities and how they've changed.
We are going to continue our conversation. My guest is Kyle Swenson. He's an award-winning journalist and author of the new book, Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. The story comes out of Cleveland. That's the bad city. We'll talk about how it has and hasn't come to reckon with its past regarding the fates of Ricky Jackson, Willie Bridgman, and Ronnie Bridgman, the three young men who were accused, convicted, sentenced to death at one point, and eventually in 2014 exonerated of the murders of a salesman in East Cleveland. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Innocent people have served a combined 20,000 plus years in prison in the U.S. most have been black. The story replays over and over again across the country. We're talking about the issue of wrongful convictions, where the U.S. criminal justice system falls short, and how the cities too often sit back and watch the injustice unfold. Award-winning journalist Kyle Swenson has written a new book about the larger issue through the lens of a particularly heinous example out of Cleveland, where three young black men were wrongly arrested, tried, and convicted for the murder of a man. Between them, they spent 106 years in prison before their exoneration in 2014. Swenson's new book is titled Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. Kyle Swenson appears tonight at the King Arts Complex. For more information, go to the link at WOSU.org/allsides. And Kyle Swenson's with us right now. So if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. I want to talk about who the three young men were then and who they are now. And I want to us to listen to first a cut from StoryCorps where Ricky Jackson is talking with the eyewitness who was has later said he was coerced into giving the information to the police. Let's listen.
I went through 39 years of incarceration because of some things that you put in motion.
Right.
Throughout the years, did you ever think about me?
Yeah, I wanted to trade places because I said it should be me instead of them. And as I grew up, I was depressed, suicidal. It ate me up so much inside, man.
I used to think about you a lot. Hatred, loathing. I even used to fantasize about ways that I was going to kill you. We didn't have any physical evidence to bring back into court. Mm-hmm. It was just you.
When I came forth, I was tired. I couldn't live no more like that, Ricky. I know that so much was taken away from y'all so many years. Y'all deserved y'all freedom.
Wow, Kyle Swenson.
Powerful.
Yeah, it is powerful. And it wasn't just the 12-year-old. It was the whole neighborhood.
Yes, yeah. I mean, a lot of people could have come forward with
they
information.
They knew these were good kids.
They definitely did. But like I said, it was the factor of fear, I think, in the neighborhood about getting involved with the police that really kept people quiet.
Did they tell you that?
Yes. And that was very prevalent. A lot of them, you know, as adults were very much felt guilt about how they had been quiet and felt guilt about, you know, the way that their silence had helped contributed in a way to these guys and what was taken from them.
So who were they back in 1975.
So 1975, Ronnie Bridgman was the youngest. He was 17. He was just kind of getting into his own. He had a great, and still does, has a great kind of magnetic personality. Always knew the right jokes to tell. Always knew the great story to tell to kind of win over a room. Could kind of like pull people very close to him with just by sheer force of his great personality. Ricky Jackson was his best friend. He was 18, and Ricky was kind of a loner growing up. His family had kind of jumped all around the East Side from house to house as he was a kid. But he was very quiet, but also very observant, very, very, very sharp and smart about reading rooms and reading people. And Wiley Bridgman was older. He was, you know, when you're 17 or 18, I like to say you're not, your personality is still kind of in flux. You're not fully formed yet. Wiley, though, was in his early 20s. He was definitely an adult, kind of very cerebral man, young man. He was a deep thinker, a deep reader. He wrote poetry, listened to classical music. He was very plugged in at the time to what we would call the Black Power movement and Afro Pride movements. So he knew very much about what was happening on the streets and was very plugged in to the power dynamics at play. And I think that made his personal situation very terrible because he knew kind of what was happening. He knew the racism that was stacked against them when they were taken into the legal system.
He wasn't shocked?
No, the way he would always describe it, I think, was that it was very hard because he was the oldest and he couldn't do anything about this for his younger brother and their good friend. And he knew what was happening, but still he was powerless to do anything.
How did the police, what happened with Edward Vernon? How he said what he said, but he also says he was coerced into saying it. What happened? What do we know?
So Edward Vernon, when he would later recant his testimony after decades, he explained that you know, he had volunteered to help with the police. He didn't really know anything, but, you know, he was trying to be a good kid. He was trying to help the authorities. What ended up happening was he was taken in for a lineup to see suspects, including Ricky Jackson and Wiley Bridgman. Ed's idea was that he wouldn't point anyone out of the lineup and he would just go home and it would end there. But unfortunately, after he didn't pick anyone out of the lineup, according to Edward, he was taken into a back room and a police officer started throwing chairs around and smacking the table and got very violent and angry and said that he would charge Edward's parents with perjury if he didn't go forward and help them with this case. And of course, you're dealing with a 12-year-old boy. You're dealing with a scared, terrified child. So Edward agreed to help. And right there, the police sat down and they typed out a statement.
There was no lawyer.
There were no, not at all. But they sat down and typed out this statement implicating the three guys from the neighborhood.
Where were their parents?
Their parents were, you mean the three guys? They were completely bewildered by this. I know that they were in court, they went, but these were, you know, they weren't wealthy families. They didn't have money for paying for private attorneys. And I think they were bewildered and very scared as well for what were happening to their sons here. And I think there was a powerlessness as well on their part about they had nothing that they could do for their sons, really, which must be a terrifying thing to have to go through.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the 1975 case that found three innocent people found guilty, nonetheless, because of inaccurate testimony by a 12-year-old boy. My guest is Kyle Swenson. He's an award-winning journalist and author of the new book, Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. Maybe you remember the case out of Cleveland. You can give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Did they have anyone who stood by them at the time?
Well, their families were there, definitely, but, you know, coming to visit them while they were being held in jail. But
public defenders?
They had lawyers. They were given lawyers at the time in Cleveland. Judges basically handed out, I write about in the book, basically the judges and defense attorneys would be drinking at the same bar in the afternoon, and that's where they would hand out, the judges would hand out assignments for representing defendants. And some of their lawyers, I think, put up a good fight. You know, they had three separate trials, so there were a number of defense attorneys involved. Some put up the best fight they could with what little evidence and material they had. Others, I think, didn't put up as great a fight, obviously. But at the end of the day, Edward Vernon testified in these trials. It was basically his word versus these three young men's word. And the juries all believed Edward.
That's why I still always go back to, but didn't they find witnesses who could place them somewhere else at the time of the crime?
Those people were out there. They were never interviewed. They were never interviewed by defense attorneys. But like I mentioned, they also didn't step up on their own to help.
And in as far as culpability goes, I guess it kind of starts with the coerced testimony to begin with. But then it just goes on from there.
Yeah, there were a lot of layers to this. You know, the silence of the neighbors who knew something. I think that there's a level of culpability there as well. Edward, obviously, carries a lot of this blame because he got up there and made this testimony. But then you have to look at the police and the prosecutors, particularly the police department, who forced this terrified child to take the witness stand and make these statements.
You've said that we're responsible for what we see in the world and for what we don't see. That's something that you've come to believe. It's sort of like we're responsible for picking up the rock and looking underneath it, right?
Yeah.
Are we getting any better at that with the exonerations, with the Innocence Project, that kind of a thing?
I think, you know, the Ohio Innocence Project does amazing work. And Innocence Projects across the country, they do really critical work. I think one thing that I've noticed, at least over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, is it seems people are more willing in general to acknowledge that there are issues with the criminal justice system, that we don't have a perfect system, that we have a system that needs to be watched and fixed and corrected. And I think that the more people that accept that and are honest about that and open to that idea, I think we can get better as a system.
Ohio is one of the states that provides financial compensation.
Yeah.
And they did and they did get millions between them. Tell us about how they're living now.
Well, they definitely, you know, Ohio does have statutes in place to do that, and they did receive some financial compensation. Obviously, that doesn't give back what was taken. I mean, you're talking about cumulatively 106 years.
Yeah.
But their lives, I mean, what is most remarkable and what I think I've learned the most from being around these incredible men is that their strength has really endured them, and they haven't let this be the defining factor of their lives. You know, Kwame Ajamu is married. So is Ricky Jackson. Ricky Jackson was recently married. Wiley Bridgman has a beautiful home. They all have carried on, and they've all defined their lives in a new way beyond this particular case, which I think is amazing and wonderful and a great example.
There's a story in the book. I can't remember which one, but his dog dies. And you're
Ricky.
There. You happen to be there to interview him. Mm-hmm. And is that Riley?
That was Ricky Jackson.
Ricky.
Yeah.
And it was so sad, and he really loved this dog, and
he did,
he'd become very attached to it. And you said later how sorry you were about that. And he told you had some interesting insight on his response to his dog's dying.
He had said, you know, I said, I'm so sorry. And it was terrible to see the dog get killed that way. And he
hit
was very emotional.
Car.
He was hit by a car.
Sudden,
yeah, I should say. It was hit by a car. He was very emotional. And a few days later, I came back and we were talking and we were doing an interview. And later when I was leaving, I said, you know, I feel terrible about what happened to the dog. You know, I'm so sorry. And he said, yeah, I mean, it's terrible. I feel really bad. But then he had mentioned, you know, but in a way, I'm happy that I could feel that I had those feelings. I'm glad that I could still be so attached and love something that way, because for a long time, I was worried that I just wasn't able to feel and have those depths of emotion about anything anymore. And I thought that was really powerful, because that was a great fear about him, for him, that his feelings just wouldn't be there anymore after so many years of incarceration. And to find them through this dog, I think, was beautiful. And, you know, I think that's a great testament that to his spirit and the endurance of spirit, that he didn't let this situation kind of rub out his capacity as a human being to love and to care.
Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment, a statement. I grew up in that area back in that time, mm-hmm. So I kind of know what went on. But to me, I see the same problem exists today. A lot of people want to make especially prosecutors or judges want to make their career based off of solving problems or crimes. And the easiest way to do it is by incarcerating or making accusations against African-American men as the bad guy. And then years later, we find out that isn't the case. And like you said, once they're exonerated, then we make it out like, what's going to be your first? What is the first thing you want to eat?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the life or career that they could have had that was snuffed out just because of, I feel, a system that is still unjust. And I guess I just want to know what the caller thinks about that as far as when he was writing his book and researching.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's a great point. I think we have a criminal justice system that is obviously overtaxed by just the number of arrests that we have. Prosecutors are overtaxed. Defense attorneys are overtaxed. I mean, there's just so many people moving through the criminal justice system on a day-to-day basis that it's really kind of frightening to see all these lives go through. And that is a systemic problem that we as a country have to deal with. And I hope, you know, fingers crossed, that we're beginning to move in that direction, I think. We're at least having those conversations.
Fred, thanks for that call. Anybody else? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right. It's not an accident that the prison systems is overflowing in Ohio as well as everywhere else across the country. We incarcerate more people total than all the other countries in the world put together, which is shocking.
Definitely.
And there's a hugely disproportionate presence of African-American men,
mm-hmm.
In the system, although an increasing number of women as well. It's not an accident. It's
not at all. No. And you know, what's so fascinating to me is that these men had a real kind of front row seat to these changes in the American criminal justice system. In 1975, you're seeing the beginnings of, you know, what we would call today the war on crime, which would then kind of feed into the war on drugs in the 80s and lead us into this moment, which we've been in ever since, of what smarter people than I have termed the age of mass incarceration. And I remember Ricky in particular told me stories about how he noticed the changes within the prison from inside. He would say he remembered seeing guys coming in that were younger and younger, that they were staying for longer and longer, and that they kept coming back and coming back through the door more and more. And so he watched, you know, from prison as this change happened in American society and began filling prisons, like you said.
Kwame Ajamu, he formerly known as Ronnie Bridgman, he got out before the other two, right?
He did.
Why did that? Was that because of his age or why did that happen?
He had just paroled out. He was paroled out to Cleveland. It just so happened at one point, Wiley Bridgman was also paroled out, but he was then sent back to prison. And Ricky Jackson was never paroled out because he was the alleged shooter. Hmm. And so every time he would go to a parole board, they would want to hear some type of contrition or admission of guilt. And every time he'd say, I didn't do this. I have nothing to feel guilty about. And they would throw on another 10 years for him. So the chances were very, very real that Ricky Jackson would never leave prison.
Did Kwame say that he admit that he had done it?
No. Because he wasn't the alleged shooter.
Okay, gotcha.
He wasn't the alleged shooter. He just over time, they just processed him out of the system. I should say that Kwame also was an incredibly active, you know, prisoner. He worked in the prison's education system, became an administrator in the education system. He helped, I think, hundreds of people get their GED in the inside prison. He really worked very hard to have a life within the prison system and to do good within the prison system.
Were you worried about them after they got out? What would happen?
Yeah, some part of me definitely was in terms of so much is thrown at them. And
they were
gone,
so young. I
and they've gone through so much and so much has been taken. But I think I realized, you know, having spent so much time with them that they're such strong men and they've worked through so much of the stuff that you would expect in terms of like anger and fear and shame and just general frustration and hatred that you could feel that would be natural to come to a person in this situation to have so much taken from you. They've worked through all of that over the years and gotten to a place where they're not letting that eat them or define them. So you're definitely worried because so much is different now than what it was, and so much was taken. And they always talk about exonerees and people who are out there looking to take advantage of them and you know, things like that. So those are always concerns, but these men are remarkable men and they can handle it.
Do they stay in touch with each other?
They do. Yeah. I mean, they have a bond that is, you know, it would be an understatement to say it's impossible to break that bond because only the three of them know really what they went through.
We are talking about the 1975 case that sent Wiley Bridgman, Kwame Ajamu, formerly known as Ronnie Bridgman, and Ricky Jackson, three friends from East Cleveland, to prison, perhaps for the rest of their lives. They were exonerated of the murder charges in 2014 and released. My guest is Kyle Swenson. He's an award-winning journalist and author of the new book, Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. If you want to weigh in on this, you remember this time, you remember the case, or you just want to talk about the criminal justice system as it stands today, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Many believe that innocent people don't confess to crimes they didn't commit. But in 2017 alone, more than 2,000 innocent American youth, mostly 18 years or younger, did. In the case that we're talking about today in 1975, it was the eyewitness report that was coerced from a 12-year-old boy, and it sent three young men to prison for much of the rest of their lives, a total of 106 years between them for a crime they did not commit. Still with us is award-winning journalist and author of a new book about the case, Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. Kyle Swenson, he appears tonight at the King Arts Complex. For more information, go to the link at WOSU.org/allsides. This was the longest wrongful conviction in the United States?
When Ricky Jackson was released, it was the longest wrongful conviction. 39 years straight he'd been in 2014. Unfortunately, that milestone has been bested by some other cases since, which is very grim. And together, these gentlemen, the three, served 106 years, or as I say, lost 106 years of their lives.
Let's turn to some calls. Omar in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Omar.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Well, I want to comment on that also, and I would like to comment on the system and how it's run. As a young immigrant, I was just turning 18, and I went into one of the stores, and I was wrongfully accused of shoplifting by switching a tag, and it left a long, hard times, basically. I didn't know nothing about the system. I ended up going to jail for shoplifting. My parents and everybody was, you know, and I know 100% that I didn't do that, but I didn't have the means. And when I got to court, the system was just plead guilty and, you know, it's going to be okay. You're going to be on probation. And then basically, and then after 6 years, I got to expungate, and the system itself is what I believe is rigged, and it's not for the low-income or young immigrants, especially young African immigrants or African Americans. Or basically, there's no. I say it's the system, and I don't believe nothing changed much. There's a lot of young people that still go through what I've been through and what's going on around. So I would like to mention that. And
we've talked about, Omar, thank you so much, and I'm sure you've heard so many times we've talked about on the program, what is it about young black men that gets the hackles up with police? And you know, what's really going on there? And Omar, how long were you in jail? You couldn't have gone to prison for shoplifting. You went to jail, right?
Yeah, I went to the local county, and I stayed for maybe 4 hours, but the processing took about another 6-7 hours, but it was one of the worst that I ever been in.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you know, I had a family to help me out. And my family was even, you know, ignorant about it. We didn't know. And then we ended up taking a plea deal. And then after, you know, I got to know the system, I realized, wait a minute, you know, nobody investigated. The tag was still on it. I couldn't possibly switch it. Basically, you know, and I couldn't even get a job because they were saying, oh, you have a misdemeanor, you know, and I was literally just graduated from high school, and I was just turning 18. It was one of the worst times that I went through, but then, you know, luckily, it's still the system. I see young people that go through the same thing right now, and I really think nothing changes. Same old thing.
Okay. Omar, thanks.
Well, I was going to say that I think that the system is bewildering to, you know, even if you're not a recent immigrant to this country, for just people who have grown up here, you know, the moment that they're put through the system, I think, can be incredibly discombobulating. You don't understand. There's all these terms that are being thrown around.
I won't even fill out my tax forms, you know, let alone go through the criminal justice system.
Exactly. And I think that people will definitely sign away their rights by taking a plea deal and not realize the consequences down the line with employment and everything else that can be attached to it.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. Hi, and thank you so much for having me on, and I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Yes, I want to ask a question about after the young boy recounted his statements, what happened to the cops that forced him to make those false allegations?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. The officers involved had all passed away by the time Ed Vernon recanted his testimony. So this is decades later, and it came to light in 2014. And unfortunately, all the cops were gone who had been directly involved. So there was no kind of accountability for their role in this.
Thank you, Dan, for that call. Ian in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Ian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So we've spoken about the millions of dollars that these gentlemen had received as compensation for not being able to have a career or any type of training. Mm-hmm. Does the state of Ohio offer any type of vocational training or employment services to these gentlemen?
Yeah,
that's a great question, because unfortunately, exonerees don't get that type of life training, job training, vocational training, or any really type of crash course in what life will be like outside. I've mentioned a few times the Ohio Innocence Project and the amazing work they do. And they do, through their own organization and activities, they do prepare a lot of the exonerees for what's coming. And I think that's very critical and another great thing that they do with their work. But on the whole, no, the government doesn't help or have programs in place to help exonerees.
Ian, thanks a lot for that call. And Charles in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Ann. I just wanted to mention that it was Bill Clinton's crime bill that led to the mass incarceration of Black African Americans. And not one single politician, to my knowledge, white or Black, who have had the moral courage to repeal that law. That law is being used by law enforcement for forfeiture and seizure of property of people who have just been stopped, not convicted or arrested. And until we come to grips that these racist laws are part of the problem and seek to repeal them, then you're going to continue with a justice system. And I do say it's a system based on racist, white supremacist laws that end up affecting and negatively impacting Black African Americans. And our politicians do nothing to repeal those kind of laws, and they should. Shame on them.
Well, lately they've been saying they're going to do something, but right. They have a hard time getting around to doing it. Kyle Swenson?
I would say that, you know, that's correct. Not just that Clinton-era law, but there's decades and decades nationally of statutes as well.
State laws
that followed suit with that. And I think when we talk about criminal justice reform today, what we're really talking about is untangling the legacies of these laws and these statutes and these programs that had been in place for decades. And having the political will to untangle those legacies, I think, is key to any type of actual systemic reform.
Charles, thanks a lot for that call. Anyone else, if you have a question or comment for my guest, author and journalist Kyle Swenson, the number is 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You talk about racism a lot in the book. It plays a huge role in this case, as it does in many cases in the criminal justice system writ large. And you quoted one of your Kenyan professors on the nature of racism. And you said that he said that in his experience, racism isn't just institutional. It's a lack of empathy.
Absolutely.
And tell me how that fits into this case.
So I really think I'll explain it this way. When I first met Kwame Njamu in 2011 and he told me the story, I believed him. He was very credible. He had documents. There was
He contacted me
to look into this as a reporter. I believed him, but there's maybe 1% of me or maybe 1 to 10% of me held back from fully believing him at first, because I assumed that the criminal justice system had safety nets involved or guardrails that would keep an innocent person from actually being incarcerated for decades and decades. I figured there's no way that an innocent person, maybe they were convicted, but after decades and decades, there must have been some appeals process or something that would take that person out of the system. Obviously, I realize now that I was actually quite stupid of me to think that, and there's no such safety nets in the system. And I eventually realized that the only reason I had thought that to begin with had everything to do with who I was, which was white and suburban and middle class, and I had never been on the wrong end of the criminal justice system before. So that was really critical to me, and it really kind of opened my eyes about empathy and thinking about the perspective I was bringing to writing about these stories and what that informed and how I told them. And I think in reporting in general, empathy is key and critical in telling stories.
614-292 is the number to call, 292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. www.thebookbeat.org. Going forward, you know, you're spending a lot of time talking about this book now. Who's calling for you? Who wants to hear what you have to say? And what kind of feedback are you getting now that it's written?
I've been lucky and very happy to see that people seem to connect with the book. They know the issues involved, and not just Clevelanders. It seems people from across the country really understand that this is a book about, as I mentioned before, American cities and the way that our institutions have changed and become unfair in a way. So I've been really happy with the response so far. I hope people continue to read it and read it as a story about the country and where we're at and where we've been. And so I hope also that it's a full record of what happened to these individual men, these three men. And as I said before, it's important to know that history and have it there.
What have they said about the book?
They seem to have been happy with it. You know, it's hard, I know, for them to relive a lot of this.
Have they talked to you about it? I mean, there's so much detail in the book, by the way. How did you, just talking about what they were doing that day?
Yeah, I spent hours with them, obviously hours and hours and hours of interviewing, and their memories were very sharp from this time. And Ricky Jackson once described it to me as that, you know, you remember very clearly because when your life is interrupted so abruptly, that time in your life is really kind of frozen in your mind. And so the details were very vivid in their lives. And a lot of the other research was just, you know, diving through the records, looking up old newspaper clippings, just trying to create the environment, the atmosphere of the city and the country at the time.
You know, we talk about how young men are being sent to prison in droves and they come out worse than they went in. How did they keep from that? What do you know about that?
They kept from that because they always knew who they were. They always knew that they were innocent. They always knew that they didn't belong there. Kwame Ajamu once told me, you know, he wasn't a criminal. It wasn't how he was wired inside. And he felt very out of place in prison because he was around criminals a lot of the time, most of the time. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't wired in a criminal way, and he felt very out of place. And he never let himself forget about that he wasn't a criminal. He hadn't done what he had done. And I think that's a great example for all three, that they, you know, maintained who they were and they never forgot that they were innocent of this crime that they had been convicted of.
Take a quick call from Abe in Bexley. Abe, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having this conversation today.
You bet.
I know those guys. Kwame and Riley and Ricky are three of Ohio's nine exonerated death row survivors, and they're among 164 nationwide. And I just wanted to make sure that was out there. And also in Ohio, we have some things we can do. You know, in 2014, the Supreme Court Joint Task Force on the Administration of Ohio's Death Penalty made 56 recommendations to make the system more fair and accurate. 13 of those recommendations, if enacted, would help prevent wrongful convictions like what happened to these guys. Things like disallowing jailhouse snitch testimony, requiring actual proof of guilt like DNA and videotaped interrogations and confessions and more. And to date, the legislature hasn't addressed any of them. And I think that's the thing that people need to be. If we're concerned about this happening, it's not just 45 years ago. This still happens. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. No, Abe's 100% right. And there are things we can do to fix the criminal justice system. Those suggestions he outlined are key among them. And as I mentioned before, it's about the political will, having the political will to actually get these things done.
Well, Abe, thanks for that call. And everybody else, thanks for your calls today. We are out of time. Kyle Swenson is appearing at the King Arts Complex tonight to do a speaking engagement. For more information, you can check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Kyle Swenson, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Kyle Swenson, award-winning journalist and author of the new book, Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.